Marshall, if you can call a court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Werke, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. We have five cases on the calendar for today. Three are set for oral argument. This is the first one. For oral argument, this is case number A19-1986, State of Minnesota versus Antonio Level, Washington. As both of you know, we will have 15 minutes for appellant's arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for appellant on rebuttal. Just a few housekeeping items. First and foremost, thank you both very much for joining us via zoom.gov. Unfortunately, we cannot meet in person at this time. Per the Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice's order. We appreciate you joining us though virtually as like this. If we run into any technical difficulties at all, we will certainly make accommodations if we need to stop the proceedings and make sure that whoever may have lost a connection can rejoin. We've done that before and we will certainly accommodate both parties to make sure that you each have your a lot of time, and we will be recording this hearing, so no other recordings are permitted unless asked beforehand, whether oral or video recordings. And with that, I believe we can proceed. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant Antonio Washington. There is no strategic reason for defense counsel's failure to object to the damaging evidence that was introduced in this case. And if there was a strategic reason, the district court erred by not granting an evidentiary hearing to have defense counsel testify about his failure to object. At the very least, a remand is necessary here for the district court judge to grant or to hold an evidentiary hearing for defense counsel to explain his familiarity with the Litzau, Williams, and Hardy line of cases and whether his failure to object was a strategic one or something he just missed in the heat of the moment of a trial. Here, defense counsel prejudiced Mr. Washington's case by failing to object to officers' testimony that Mark Voss and Linda Selden told those officers that Antonio Washington lived in the basement bedroom of Mark Voss's home, and that the state introduced that evidence to establish that Mr. Washington exercised dominion and control and had constructive possession over the guns and drugs that were found in that bedroom. The Litzau line of cases say that it was improper for those hearsay statements to be introduced in order for the police to explain their investigation, because essentially what the police is attempting to do is to introduce hearsay statements under the guise of explaining the investigation. The district court judge—
Mr. Axelson, does the state even need to show that the statements at issue are necessary to establish constructive possession? And what I'm getting at is, you know, I'm trying to remember the feature. Snapchat, the screenshot, his name was on one of the handguns. And then in the dresser next to the heroin and cash, there's a warrant for, I believe, failure to appear. I mean, how can he be prejudiced when he likely could have been convicted, with that information? Here's my question to you. Why was that information necessary? We have other evidence that points to his guilt.
Well, that hits on the second prong of the ineffective assistance of counsel tests, and I would be happy to address
that. I totally agree with that, but you're defending the performance end. Do you agree that if we have two prongs, so we have performance and we have prejudice, do you agree that if we find one, we don't need to analyze both?
No, I agree that you should analyze both, and I think I can prevail on both prongs. First off, on the Snapchat.
Do you think that the performance prong is more powerful than, I mean, is your argument stronger on performance than it is on prejudice?
I think we can prevail on both prongs. And I think it is unquestioned that we should prevail on the first prong. Although I think that the failure here, when we stay in appeal and we go back down to the district court and we ask for a hearing and we met the 590 requirement of showing that our claim is not frivolous, that evidentiary hearing should be granted. But moving on to the second prong, because that's your concern, is that here, the evidence is not as strong or is significantly less strong without this evidence. And otherwise the state wouldn't have worked so hard to introduce it and focus so much of it in its closing argument. And here the Snapchat, which was linked to my client, the officer said there are some limitations with that. She said that somebody else could have videotaped the gun, although the gun that was shown on the Snapchat video is not shown in possession of my client. He could be proud of his, of this woman that he has a relationship with. He could be proud of the fact that she has a new gun and could take a video of it or share a video that she had taken of it, but that doesn't establish his possession based on State v. Smith. Secondly, there is a summons in the bedroom, but we explained in our brief that he has a relationship with this woman, and it doesn't establish that he lives in the bedroom just because that summons is in there.
Mr. Axelson, that summons wasn't just sitting out somewhere. That was actually in the dresser drawer. That seems to indicate that he was more just passing through that. He was settled in, not to mention the men's clothes that were on the left side of the bed, the shoes that were there, the gun and drugs that were located with that summons. That seems like pretty powerful evidence, pretty strong evidence there.
Well, we don't know who put the summons there. There was no...
Right, but the summons has his name on it.
Yes.
But the summons has his name on it, though. It's his summons.
That's correct. His girlfriend also maybe handled his legal matters for him, and he gave her the summons, and that's how it ends up in the bedroom. But that's the only piece of evidence that specifically.
No. Judge Reyes brought up the other circumstances. How do you explain the men's clothing, the all of the stuff on one side of the room and the woman's stuff on the other? I mean, those are circumstances we look at too. How do you explain that?
Well, the state had an opportunity here to test the men's clothing that was found in the bedroom. The state had the opportunity to establish that the size of the shoes were similar to what Antonio Washington wore, because we can assume that he was arrested, that day, and they could have taken the shoes that he was arrested in and compared and showed that they were the same size. They could have done DNA testing on some of that clothing to establish it was Antonio Washington's.
And
they
right.
did, the state did elicit evidence that other males lived in that house, even in addition to Mark Voss. There was a brother or Linda Selden's son also lived in that home. And that the baby father of Karen Selden frequented that home for visitation with the child. And that established some link for him to that home also. So we don't know specifically that the men's clothing that was found in that bedroom was Antonio Washington's or would establish his link to that bedroom.
But Mr. Axelson, first of all, the you're talking about evidence. All this evidence had been presented already, and the evidence of other people frequenting the house is different. Visiting the house is different than staying at the house. Second of all, with respect to the evidence that the state did not present, why does that really matter? All we're looking at is the evidence that had been presented by the state, and even the evidence that had been presented without DNA evidence or fingerprints or identification of, what size shoe he wore, there still seemed to be a lot of overwhelming evidence linking him, you look at the Snapchat video, you look at the gun, you look at the two guns that were in the bedroom, you look at the evidence that was in the dresser, clothes. I mean, it just seems like a high hurdle that you have to get over to show that that wasn't enough to connect him.
Well, the only permissible evidence that was introduced at trial did not establish that he lived in the bedroom. Mark Voss testified that he had been a social visitor to the home on a number of occasions, but he was the owner of the home and he testified that the client didn't live there. He also said that these other people frequented the house and in fact that the brother of Karen Selden lived in that home. So that was a stronger link to this house and potentially the men's clothes and some of these other items. Regarding the Taurus handgun, which was seen on the Snapchat, there was evidence that was introduced, we are contesting it, but evidence introduced that Karen Selden said that that was her gun and there was DNA taken from that gun and it linked to a major contributor as a woman, which would link into that being Karen Selden's gun. Him doing a Snapchat video does not establish possession of that gun. And State v. Smith says that being in possession of a gun, even as a felon, doesn't establish possession of that gun.
Mr. Axelson, you raise an interesting point. You seem to focus on the fact that there is evidence, there wasn't enough evidence to show that he lived there. Does it really matter whether or not he lived there if we're talking about constructive possession of a gun and you have all this evidence connecting him to the guns and the drugs?
Well, I do believe establishing that he lived there was important because otherwise the state wouldn't have asked all these officers to establish that. They wouldn't have asked these officers who lived in the bedroom and elicited all that evidence. And then they wouldn't have relied on it so extensively in their closing argument if they didn't think it mattered. Him being a social guest at that house obviously wasn't enough for the state because they had that evidence when Mark Voss testified and they continued to elicit additional evidence, which was improper and not objected to, in order to try to establish that he exercised dominion and control, which is not an easy standard to meet in establishing that somebody lives in that bedroom versus being a social guest and a friend, a visitor of Karen Selden, helps establish the link to the guns and the drugs.
But my question is it necessary? Is it a requirement to show that he actually lived there to establish the element of dominion and control for constructive possession? It doesn't seem to me that it certainly makes a stronger case, but is it even necessary to show that he lived there? The fact that he stayed there for whoever knows how much time, isn't that really enough when you look at the actual evidence that had been presented?
Well, part of the reason I didn't argue sufficiency of the evidence either in district court or on appeal is because it is possible that even without the additional evidence, it might meet the sufficiency of the evidence standard. And that's the problem here with the district court's analysis on the prejudice prong, is that it evaluated it under the sufficiency of the evidence standard. And so it is possible that there would have been enough with the summons and the Snapchat video and the fact that he was a social guest to establish dominion and control, but it is not enough if they're under the ineffective assistance of counsel prong, because but for this additional evidence saying that he did live in that bedroom, there's a reasonable probability that the jury's verdict would have been different here.
Mr. Axelson, I want to ask you one last question, and I think Judge Jessen might want to ask a question too. I want to go back to the question that Judge Warkey asked you. Isn't it true that the state only has to prevail on one prong of the Strickland test? So in other words, if you cannot show prejudice, the state would still prevail regardless of the first prong?
That's correct. If I can't prevail on the prejudice prong, then my client cannot prevail in this appeal, and then your decision would be to affirm. I don't agree that I can't prevail on that prong for the reasons that I've stated up to this point. Unless the panel has additional questions for me, I will potentially get up in my 5 minutes of rebuttal. And I once again would ask for, at the very least, a remand to the district court. I think it is a problem when both the Court of Appeals, and I'll cite, there's a case recently, actually in the last 2 years, a State v. Dobby, that's not in my brief, but the site is 2018 Westlaw 6441633. In that case, a panel of the Court of Appeals indicated that they were bothered by the fact that the district court judge had put in their own reasoning for explaining why defense counsel didn't object to something. And they said, that's not the way that that should happen, that an evidentiary hearing should take place. And they remanded it for an evidentiary hearing. And I think that it's important to send a message to district court judges, especially in cases where I'm on direct appeal. And the only reason I'm staying in is that in my 20 years of expertise of working this business, I know that there's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and that that we should at least have an evidentiary hearing for defense counsel to explain their actions and explain their failure to object. And in order to really fully develop these cases, that's the way that the process should take place. So I would ask again for, at the very least, a remand to the district court. In the alternative, I think I've made my case on why we can prevail on both prongs of the Strickland test. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Axelson. Ms. Light, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I'm representing the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this case. The court has already discussed, and I would agree with opposing counsel, that this court need not address both prongs if one prong is determinative. And I would also just start with discussing appellant's claim that this needs to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. An evidentiary hearing is not needed in this case for two reasons. First, the trial strategy conducted by the trial counsel is very clear from the transcript, both in his cross-examination of witnesses and in his closing argument. And so an evidentiary hearing is not needed to expand on what that trial strategy was. It is clear from the transcript before this court.
If I can just stop you there.
Yes.
Was failing to object to kind of the statements when the search warrant was executed, how's that inconsistent with the trial strategy? When I think about that question, I'm like, why then is the district court kind of putting the court spin on that, the answer to that question, as opposed to just having the evidentiary hearing and bringing in the defense counsel and answering what I think is a pretty basic question?
Because I believe the strategy is very clear from the transcript itself, particularly in the closing argument. You can see the trial counsel really hammering on that this was, his theory was that this was a poorly investigated case, that there is weak evidence, that it's circumstantial evidence, that it was kind of done in tunnel vision, where they were really focused on the appellant and they weren't going to look any further than that. And so that was his strategy.
I'm just trying to figure out why these failure to objects would be inconsistent in some ways, that strategy. Is that not something that we should be concerned about? I agree, reading his closing argument, you sit there and go, yes, he's pounding on failure to investigate. I don't know that that answers all of our questions. And shouldn't those questions have been talked about in evidentiary hearing?
Sure, so if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that his decision to not object may have been inconsistent with his strategy?
I think that's a question. If you're saying, it's one thing to say, this is the strategy. And so my question is, well, was the failure to object consistent with that strategy or not, right? Because just saying it's the strategy doesn't answer the question. And
sure,
if that's an open question, then don't we need an evidentiary hearing to address it?
So the other reason that we don't need an evidentiary hearing in this case is because the appellant cannot prevail on the prejudice prong. and an evidentiary hearing would not expand at all on the prejudice analysis. What's before this court, and the court could decide this case alone on the second prong to and determine that there is no reasonable probability that the verdict would have been different but for these alleged errors.
And my question there on the prejudice prong is, you know, I'd look at this a little differently if the prosecutor here hadn't come back in the rebuttal and talked about this testimony. I mean, because when I read the closing, I thought, okay, he mentions Mark Voss's, you know, comment, but it's in the context of talking about the search warrant for execution. But it's like when he comes back to that on rebuttal, and that's his one of his main rebuttal points to this, it was a faulty investigation. It makes me question whether or not there is reasonable possibility, but for the errors, the verdict would have been different. So if you could address that, I would appreciate it.
Sure. You know, I'll start out by saying, you know, in the principal closing argument of the prosecutor, you know, she really touches on the ample evidence before the jury that shows constructive possession of all the other things that this panel has already discussed with the appellant of the men's clothing in the bedroom, the summons with the appellant's name on it, and the date of the summons being November 17th, just days before the execution of the search warrant, you know, linking the firearm to his Snapchat videos, and his Snapchat videos also including, you know, stacks of money, and the surveillance that was done linking, you know, having him driving a BMW car that he said belonged to his girlfriend, which was Karen Zeldin. So there's ample evidence that she really focused on in the bulk of her closing argument to support constructive possession. And then, you know, I think touching on the subject of the search warrant or, you know, the other information that the police collected when executing that search warrant was really to show why they were executing a search warrant on this residence and why they directed and focused their search in the basement bedroom. So it's really to explain the conduct of the police rather than to really go to the heart of an element.
And I do understand that in the initial closing argument, as I said, but it was this is the thing that came back, the prosecutor came back to on rebuttal.
And so there I would respond, I think similarly, I think the post-conviction court touched on this as well, saying that that was very limited, that the prosecutor came back to that and touched on it. It was just a couple lines in this voluminous transcript. Is just one thing that the jury heard among everything else. The jury also heard the trial counsel's thorough closing argument as well, poking holes in the investigation. So I would say that, you know, those couple lines in the rebuttal should not carry much weight in the overall totality of the evidence. So, you know, I guess I would also discuss the Litzau, if I'm pronouncing that case correctly, line of cases that the appellant asserts is, you know, supportive of his request and of an outcome in this case. When actually in that case in Litzau, the court says that it is not hearsay to testify that a tip was received that the testimony is to explain why the police conducted surveillance. There's also other case law indicating that it's not hearsay when an out-of-court statement is offered to show why a witness, you know, contacted police or took some action. And so that's the bulk of the testimony that the appellant is challenging in this case really goes to explain why the police did what they did, why certain actions were taken, why the search was focused in the bedroom downstairs. So it really doesn't go to the heart of trying to prove an element of the case. It's really to explain to the jury the investigation that the police conducted and kind of and how that investigation, you know, barred out. So for one, not only was it trial strategy and therefore objectively reasonable, many of these instances were admissible, or I argue all of them. All of the testimony was admissible as non-hearsay. And so there was no reason for the trial counsel to object. And so all of his decisions, whether based on accurate reading of hearsay law or as a strategic decision to not object, all of his decisions to not object was objectively reasonable. And as we've already touched on, you know, that's the first prong. And then the second prong being that there was no prejudice in this case. You know, I think I also would just take a moment to remind the court of the standard in ineffective assistance of counsel cases, where, you know, the question is not, could he have objected? Would he have prevailed on a certain objection or not? The question is really, was his conduct overall so ineffective as to undermine the proper functioning of an adversarial process and deprive the appellant of a fair trial? In these isolated instances where the trial counsel was making, you know, a judgment call, a strategic call, analyzing hearsay law during a trial, from his perspective at the time, each decision he made was objectively reasonable. I believe I've touched on all the main points I wanted to make. So unless there are any additional questions, I would just say that in conclusion, the appellant did receive effective assistance of counsel in this case and did receive a fair trial. We request that this court affirm his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Light. Mr. Axelson, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Going back to Judge Jessen's question regarding inconsistency with his trial strategy and failure to object, the Dobby case, which I cited to earlier, is actually really clear on this point. In that case, defense counsel successfully stipulated to keep the defendant's criminal history out prior to trial. I think it was a felon in possession case, but then in direct testimony elicited the defendant's criminal history, which was totally inconsistent with trying to keep that testimony out. And here we have almost that exact same thing. Here, defense counsel is back on his heels once that evidence linking him to the bedroom comes in, attempts to cross-examine and undercut and try to say that that evidence is inconsistent with Mark Voss's testimony, when all he had to do was object, and under the Litzau line of cases, the evidence stays out. Additionally, they tried to say that, you know, and as I argue in my prejudice prong, that there's no link between him and the clothes, there's no DNA, there's no fingerprints or anything else, again, to remove his link to that bedroom. So the best way to do that would have been to object to the officers testifying that that was in fact his bedroom, and that these people had, people who lived in that house had told the officers that he lived in that bedroom. That evidence, whether it's hearsay or not, Litzau says it doesn't come in. Litzau and Williams and Hardy says whether that evidence qualifies as hearsay or not, because it goes to the police investigation, it doesn't come in because of the prejudicial nature of that evidence.
Mr. Axelson, I think you said something that kind of hits on a key point. You talked about how, you know, the best way to handle this would have been to object, et cetera, et cetera. But isn't that really 2020 hindsight, where we're, you know, armchair quarterbacking, so to speak, of, you know, what the Kansas City Chiefs, I'm sorry, I digress, of what, you know, a defense counsel should have done. But I mean, defense counsel, as you know, they're in the heat of the moment, and you literally have split seconds to decide whether to object or whether to let evidence in. There might have been, from our perspective now, looking back, a better way to try it, but nobody's guaranteed a perfect trial. And as counsel had mentioned, it was the representation so ineffective that the party was certainly prejudiced in it. I mean, isn't that really just what you're talking about, really just part of the trial strategy of figuring out what to do and how to counter evidence that's coming in or statements that are made, and how to best address that?
Well, I would say here is it is so obviously non-admissible evidence based on this established line of cases that's been around for 20 years that I don't have the police reports in front of me, but I would assume that the police put some of this stuff in their police reports. Otherwise, they wouldn't have testified to it. So defense counsel would have been aware prior to trial that the police had information from both Mark Voss and Linda Selden that they had told the police that he lived in that bedroom. So a prepared defense attorney would go into trial knowing how to keep that evidence out based on established case law. So I don't think this is a heat of the moment mistake by defense counsel. I think it's a failure to have knowledge of that case law. And the case law on ineffective assistance of counsel is clear that not doing a proper investigation into the facts and the law does not qualify as strategy. So we do have a caveat here where this is not strategy if you're not familiar with cases directly on point that would keep the evidence out. And just quickly on prejudice, on page 26 and 27 of my brief, I have big block quotes of how much the state relied on this evidence, and not both in closing argument, but also in rebuttal. This was the state's strongest evidence, and they pounded it to the jury. And, you know, but for defense counsel's, failure to hold to a reasonable, standard, this evidence came in and it changed the result here. But if nothing else, I would ask for a remand to the district court to have defense counsel testify, and maybe that resolves the case on its own. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and the briefs. Very well done on both. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the statutory timeframe, which is 90 days. Thank you again, and please stay safe.